From Radio Vermont, it's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV. It's your show about the people, places, and the issues that matter the most to you. Now here's your host, Dave Graham.
Good morning, Vermont. It is Wednesday, May the 20th, 2020, and glad to have you tuning in for another edition of the Dave Graham Show here on WDEV, and going to be offering up some good guests this morning for their thoughts and comments about various things. One of them is Steve Pappas. He is the editor of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, and editor and publisher of these days, I should clarify. And Steve is a very thoughtful guy. I really enjoy having him on the program, and we're going to just talk about some of the recent developments in the news, etc., here on the Dave Graham Show. And then in the second half hour, we've had some different folks on recently talking about the local food movement in Vermont. Had some people from the College of Agriculture and Life Sciences at the University of Vermont on a couple of weeks ago. Today we're focusing on something being done by the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Shane Rogers is going to be visiting with us about the Rooted in Vermont project. It is really designed to get people excited about using local foods in recipes and that sort of thing. One of the items we're going to talk about, I think, might have to do with catching fish in local lakes and rivers around Vermont and then making some delicious meals out of them. So, and that's a good segue into the later discussion we're going to be having on the program with angler Chris Bouchard and state fisheries biologist Sean Good. Of course, we are now well into fishing season here in Vermont. A lot of folks are getting out there on the theory that this is good social distancing. After all, you want to be at least 6 feet apart to keep your lines from getting tangled. And fishing is a really good outdoor activity these days. We're going to be talking to Chris Bouchard and Sean Good about that in the second hour. But first, I wanted to check in with Steve Pappas this morning, and joins us, I think, from his home, I suspect. But good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Yes, I'm sitting here at the home office realizing that I need to mow the lawn.
Well, we'll only keep you for half an hour or so, and then you can get out there, and maybe by that time the morning dew will be off of it, and you won't have to fight with a whole lot of moisture left over from the overnight. So there you go. We're trying to strategize here for you. You know that. We always try
Thank
to help.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Hey, by the way, one of the distinction, and we've talked about it in the past, I definitely prefer title of editor, because the publisher, you know, all that means is I'm the whack-a-mole for the ownership. So definitely relate more to the editor role than I do the publisher role.
Okay.
And so feel free. I mean, you can say editor and publisher, but I know the role. I have the role. But far as the community is concerned, I'd much rather be the editor than the publisher.
Okay. Not to mention chief cook and bottle washer, right?
Well, and toilet scrubber and, you know, apparently lawnmower as well. So, yes, there's a whole lot going on.
A whole lot going on, yep. That's the way these days, especially in the news media where there's shall we say, tight staffing. Maybe that's the polite way to put it. Hey, I wanted to ask you about a big local story that appeared. It really kind of popped up last Friday. The federally funded food distribution program, which zeroed in on the Knapp Airport in Berlin. And there was a reaction and response to that from local folks that was, I think, a little shocking to probably the people, the Vermont National Guard and others involved in putting on the food distribution effort, and as well as just general casual observers looking at all the people turning out.
Yeah. Well, so Jeb Wallace Broder, who took the photograph that was the lead art of the paper on Saturday, he and I were talking about this very thing this morning, and we've talked about it as a company yesterday, because nobody really saw they knew there was a potential that there were going to be a lot of people turning out for that food distribution. And those events are taking place all around the state. It's not like this was an isolated event. They're happening almost daily in locations well into June. And this one had been publicized, and there had been a lot of social media sharing, but not anything to the degree that we saw happen. And Jeb captured a photo from the end of the runway that it looks like a Phish concert. It looks like, you know, something very unexpected. It's lines of cars up and down the runway, out into the roads, and what the photo doesn't capture is that it went all the way up off the interstate. I mean, these lines of vehicles were massive, and it was folks, you know, coming to collect a box of food that included milk, cheese, chicken, produce, a few other things, and they obviously ran out, and Dave Delcourt had a story in yesterday's paper on the front page that if anybody was touched by that event, you'll want to read it, because it basically talks about what broke down there and what folks learned, what organizers learned from that, because there were thousands of people, no exaggeration, Dave, thousands of people in cars, in lines, trapped for up to 6 or 8 hours on the roads up there, and then came out empty-handed. Jeb's photo, which he posted on Facebook before it was published in print, he just thought people should know that it was going on, because Dave Delcourt had people calling him from the line of traffic saying, "What is going on up here? You know, you need to get somebody up here." And Jeb was able to get this photo, post it within a very short amount of time. It had thousands of people engaged with it. I'm looking at it right now on our website. It has 88,023 people reached and 34,627 engagements. It was shared 826 times and has 357 comments. And
wow.
People are still talking about it because it was unfortunately, it was one of those situations where if something could go wrong, it did go wrong. So there was not a good process by which kind of the information got out there that this was food for, I mean, it basically sounded like it was food for everybody, but it wasn't. It was, you know, this is food designed for people who were in need, but a lot of people went out to get the food because it sounded like, hey, there's free food being given away at the airport. And
well, let me ask you about that, because I mean, is this a sign of maybe you know, more hunger and desperation in the Central Vermont region than any of us were aware of, or is this a sign of people just hearing, "Hey, free food, let's go line up"?
I think the answer is yes to both of those things. I think that I serve on the board of directors of Capstone Community Action, and Sue Mentor, who's the executive director there, is regularly reporting to us that the demand there's been a significant demand on the providing meals to the community. And you know, keep in mind, unemployment rate right now in Vermont is just like everywhere else, is very high. There are people who people who haven't been struggling who are struggling now and are not used to finding themselves struggling in the same kind of way. And so the demand is definitely there. Unfortunately, what it sounds like happened on Friday was that it was also everybody else wanted some food too. And again, there was no vetting per se of who could show up. It sounded like anybody could show up, and social media is an amazing thing that way, right? You know, you put that out there that there's going to be free food at the airport and for anybody, and people are going to show up. The messaging on that program is different today than it was on Friday. And they are being far more careful about how people, you know, how they manage the sites. You know, on Friday, the there were people who were waiting so long that they needed to go to the bathroom. And where do you go when you're sitting in your car for 6 or 8 hours at a time?
Yeah.
And there were people relieving themselves in public, on the side of the road, on the, you know, at the edge of the runway. And, you know, all of a sudden it stopped being kind of an event that was meant to be helpful, and it became an event that quickly went off the rails. And we had one person who submitted a photo to us that showed two males, in a BMW, smoking cigars, waiting in line at that event. So I'm willing to bet that they didn't necessarily, I don't know, I shouldn't judge, didn't strike me as somebody who needed a box of food.
Well, you know, I tell you, that may be an extreme case of some of the phenomenon that was occurring up there, but I heard others remark that boy, there were a lot of you know, nice late model cars in that line, as in these, you know, the underlying sentiment, certainly these people are not at all poor and desperate, etc. And the thought that I had in response to that was just, yeah, well, a lot of people bought their cars before, say, February. Right. Or March, and then are laid off all of a sudden in February or March, and they are unable to get through the maze of whatever at the State Department of Labor to start collecting unemployment insurance. And they're really, frankly, by now, yeah, they have a nice car in the driveway, but they don't have much in the way of groceries in the cupboard, you know?
Right, which is why I qualified it by saying I shouldn't judge, because, you know, it is a bit of a reach, but if you look at the comments that are on our site and on our Facebook page, you will definitely see that there were people who were having a tough time, who were griping about the fact that they were put in a tough time on Friday and they didn't appreciate having to wait. And, you know, people really jumped on them. People really have been very aggressive on this issue of saying, you know, well, I know, you know, people calling other people out saying, I know you didn't need to be there. You know, there are people in Central Vermont who needed to be there and didn't get the help that they did need. So it's, I mean, it has been the buzz for the last 4 days, and it's gone down a little bit, but now we're starting to see letters to the editor about it and commentaries about it, basically talking about what you're talking about, which is, you know, are we seeing a shift? Is Vermont seeing a shift now in what the need is because of the toll that the pandemic is playing on the different sectors of not just the economy, but on society in general? And so, you know, it was an unfortunate day for folks, but it was a very revealing day for you know, kind of what the demands are, what the needs are, and unfortunately how poorly we can behave sometimes.
Well, I got an email here just popped in from a listener in Waterbury who says, "Don't forget how opportunistic humans are. It would scare you if we really knew." And, you know, I think there may be a point there. I think maybe there's a reminder that needs to be issued here, which I'll go ahead and take a stab at it. Hey, folks, if you're not really in need, these programs are set up for people in need. If you're not really in need, you know, if you have enough food, if you are, or if you have, you know, an income stream that allows you to go to the grocery store and sort of live a normal life in this regard, please do. You know, don't go up and get in this line and clog it up for others who are in need, and maybe even take, you know, take one of a dwindling number of boxes of food, depriving someone else whose kids are going to be hungry that night as a result. I just think that people need to think and actually, you know, reflect on their where they are in their own position, and not just grab, you know, that's something I hope people will reflect on, and maybe if behavior needs to change in any individual or people out there, let's see it happen. You know, I mean, I don't think we just cured it all right there, but a gentle reminder now and then probably isn't a bad thing. What do you think, Mr. Editor?
Well, now I think I don't have to write that editorial, so thanks, Dave.
No.
Yeah, I mean, that has been the prevailing thought, and it's been hard the last few days to kind of get my head around what happened. I needed Dave Delcourt to do that story in Tuesday's paper to kind of pull the threads apart on what happened there, because it was, if you're going to have a cluster like that and it's going to go as badly as it did, you kind of need to know why it went as badly as it did. And we know a lot of the factors from the organizational level now. And again, they learned. And P.S., this was not the first food distribution they had done. I mean, this is in the state. The organizers of this had done other events. So this was not new to them. But something, and something contributed to the massive number of people who showed up. And I'm not sure they completely identified how and why the messaging and the word got out the way it did to elicit that kind of a response. You know, some people were joking, well, it was a nice day. Well, that doesn't really mean anything. I'm not sure it requires a nice day to go sit in your car for 8 hours.
I guess the other aspect of that that might enter in here is just to the extent that people are out of work or home from school, or their normal Friday activities were not happening, they had time, and I think a lot of folks are frankly have been sitting at home kind of looking for some excitement, and oh gee whiz, let's go line up at the airport. It'll be at least a little bit of a change of pace, even though I don't think anybody's idea of a good time is just sitting in their car in a line for 8 hours.
And one of the big contributing factors to this was that the folks had started lining up very early in the morning for this, before, far earlier than it was actually scheduled to begin. And the trucks of food couldn't get to the site because the roads were blocked. The event actually started pretty significantly later than they had anticipated. And so people were already kind of fired up before the event even started. So after a few hours of sitting there and texting and posting pictures from, being in lines of traffic or lines of stopped cars, it started to become shrill. And the mood changed in a way that, elicited 88,000 views of a single photograph on our Facebook page and on our website. I mean, it's just kind of crazy.
Yeah, it is. Let me ask you about Jeb and his picture taking. Did he get up in the air for that? Was he in a plane? Or, that was looked like a big aerial shot, right?
I think he's on a hill. I don't think he's
on a hill. Okay.
Yeah. I did ask him recently because, as I said, we've gotten some commentaries on it since, and I wanted to use a different angle of the event if he had one. And he said, all my shots kind of look the same. So,
yeah. Sometimes geography enforces that.
Right now, and will text me and say, "No, I have other shots. I was in the plane, but I don't think he's in the plane. I believe he was on solid footing on the ground on the hill nearby."
I see. Okay. Well, he's a terrific photographer, and he really hit one out of the park that day, because sometimes the photo just really grabs the kind of enormity of a scene, and he managed to do that very much so on Friday. So, I mean, all in a day's work for him. As I say, he really knows what he's doing with his cameras, you guys are lucky to have. You've had a succession of excellent photographers over the years, and it's always been an impressive thing. So,
what was great about
Yeah, go ahead.
Throw out there what was great about the event, about that specific news event on on Friday, was that I was more or less unaware of it up here on the hill in Plainfield. Dave Delcor was aware of it because people in the line were calling him and reaching out to him. He reached out to Jeb. Jeb got up there, and Jeb's immediate response was, "Steve, you need to get a story on this today." It wasn't even an option. It was like, "You need to get a story," and I couldn't. Dave and Eric were already working on other things, and you know, I literally had a major news event unfolding in my, you know, right there in the backyard, kind of a thing, and I couldn't do anything about it. And so we led the paper with it, and then did the follow-up story. But he was the one pushing me, saying, "You don't know what you've got. You know, there's something major happening here."
Yeah. So, hey, let's take a call from a listener here. We only have a few minutes to go, but let's get Mary on the line. Mary from Randolph. Good morning.
Hi. Good morning, gentlemen. Yes. Just a quick note. My very wise 90-year-old mother said quite a few weeks ago, when this whole pandemic started, that this event will bring out the best in people and the worst in people. And I think this situation with the food drop is a perfect example.
Yeah, I think you might have a point there. What do you think, Steve?
Yeah, I mean, I think as your emailer indicated as well, we tend to be opportunistic when certain things happen like this, and you know, I think we've touched on a lot of the contributing factors: the free time element, the free food element, the nice day element, and all of those things added up to a lot of Central Vermonters not getting the services they needed on Friday. And that is the worst of who we are as a society right now. And there are a lot of people who are eating well, who probably, know better, and, you know, should be ashamed of themselves.
Well, here's an email from a listener in Middlebury who says there are some people who are picking up for people who do not have, who do have a real need but no car. And I'm wondering what about that idea? In addition, this listener asks, has anything been done to prevent the same thing from happening in Middlebury today? So what do you know about the organizational issues here, and whether the changes are being made as they prepare for, subsequent food distribution points?
So there were a large number of, at least according to Dave's article, there was a large number of folks who were waiting, didn't have vehicles, and had somebody else going up on their behalf. And again, the vetting process wasn't happening well enough to get, you know, the mix of who needed the service, you know, who kind of was there legitimately and who wasn't. It's my understanding from talking to Dave and his article, reading his article, that they have made some changes. They're being very clear about limits. They're being very clear about, who they want to have their, for need. They're going to be kind of separating groups out at the different locations now, and I don't think they've gone as far as like a reservation process, but they're moving in a direction like that, where you're basically signing up to pick up, and it's not going to just be open to everybody anymore. So,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say steps are being taken.
Yeah, it seems like better management, sort of site management is needed. Mary, if you're still there, I thank you very much for the call. I neglected to do that a moment ago, but interesting questions. Let's see here. Steve, the other interesting news in yesterday's paper was the governor's comment about Vermont being, or one of the other interesting pieces of news, Vermont's Governor Phil Scott talking about the state being the envy of the nation in terms of its coronavirus response and management and now occurrence. And what do you think about that comment?
I think it's deserved. I think that we are the envy of the nation. If you look from May 5th until May 12th, we had very few, if not, it was single-digit number of new cases in the state and no deaths. And then we had one more. So in a two-week period, we've had one death that was COVID-related, reported death that we are at least aware of. We flattened the curve. We did what we said we were going to do. We are seeing that as a result of that and the data being put forth that we're, slowly but steadily reopening our economy and our downtowns in a way that other states have not been able to do or can't do because they have too many cases. And it seems to be that we're, other than our previous half hour of conversation, people are being responsible. It's a testament to Vermonters that they are, they have been doing what they needed to do to get this thing under control. Now, what happens next is a big question mark.
For sure.
From people coming here who have second homes to people soaking to stop social distancing because they want to be together and hanging out, we'll know more in the next few weeks because, I think the next 2 to 3 weeks are going to be very, very telling.
All right. Well, Steve Pappas, the editor of the Times Argus and Rutland Herald, thank you so much for joining me this morning. We're about out of time, but I always appreciate talking with you.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Yep. Hey, we're going to take a brief break here on the Dave Graham Show. And when we return, we're going to be talking with Shane Rogers of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back shortly.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back, and we're going to talk with Shane Rogers this next 25 minutes or so here on the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM. He is with the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, which is has organized a Rooted in Vermont promotion about local foods in our state. But before we proceed with all of that, I want to make a couple of announcements. One is that stay tuned after 11 o'clock this morning. We're going to be going to another edition of Governor Phil Scott's regular news conferences. He brings in other top state officials, and together they make various announcements related to the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis and what's being opened, what rules might be being relaxed at this stage of the game, and so on and so forth. And so always interesting and informative events with the governor and his folks that seem to occur Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at 11 a.m. We're carrying them all live here on WDEV, FM, and AM. And I should add to that, by the way, that Bill Sayre's Common Sense Radio program, which normally airs between 11 and 12 in the morning, will not be heard today. Bill's got a day off out of respect for the governor and the state officials who are going to be making various announcements related to the COVID-19 crisis. And the other thing I wanted to mention was that I got a follow-up email. There was a correspondent who sent a note in during that first segment from Middlebury talking about today's event, a food distribution program down there. The person followed up with a note saying that according to Facebook postings in the area, the folks there are already seeing big traffic jams around the food distribution site. A lot of folks are lamenting what occurred in Berlin last Friday when there were thousands of cars and people lined up to get food from a free distribution site. Remember, folks, if you don't really need it, it's not just a matter of, hey, free food, let's go down and get ourselves, a bargain or whatever. This is for people who actually need it. And if there's that much need out there, our economy is in maybe bigger trouble than we thought. If there are folks just looking for a freebie, that's a different story. And unless you want to sit in a traffic jam all day and force others who actually need to be there also to sit in a traffic jam, please stay away. If you don't have a genuine need, please stay away. That's my advice. All right. Well, let's bring in Shane Rogers, the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund and rooted in Vermont. And I believe he's on the telephone this morning. Good morning, Shane.
Hey, Dave. Thanks for having me.
I'm glad to do it. And so tell us first off about the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund, and then let's zero in on the Rooted in Vermont program. And start with Section A of the question, please.
Sure. So the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund is a nonprofit that really works throughout Vermont on various different sectors. And the sector that I work in specifically is on Vermont's food system. And VSJF is the backbone organization for the Vermont Farm to Plate Network. And the Vermont Farm to Plate Network is a total of about 350 organizations and businesses and agencies that are working towards Vermont's food system plan. So they're working on everything from, you know, distribution and aggregation to food access to land access and everything in between. And I am specifically working on a program and a project that we call Rooted in Vermont. And what we're doing with Rooted in Vermont is we're really trying to celebrate how all Vermonters have been doing local food things for generations, right? So think everything from hunting and fishing to foraging and gardening, and really also getting down to just making sure that people feel good about, you know, picking up that block of Cabot cheddar from their grocery store when they go out. Because as we're seeing right now, especially, Vermont is positioned pretty well to have a resilient food system where our farmers are working really hard, you know, to feed their communities. And all the support that we can give as consumers to not only make sure that our small farms continue to exist after this, but to really shore up some of those cracks that we're starting to see in the food system now that this pandemic has hit.
Yeah, you know, I tell you, I had a couple of folks on, I think it was the week before last, from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences. We had this Seeds to Society segment every Thursday, second hour, which has now gone on summer vacation, but we're hoping we'll be back in the fall. And these folks from the University of Vermont College of Agriculture and Life Sciences were talking about local foods in Vermont. And I asked them to tell me how close Vermont was to, if it had a goal of imagining itself as an island and able to sustain itself on food grown, you know, either within the state or within, you know, maybe 50 miles of our borders or whatever, New Hampshire, New York, Massachusetts, Quebec, how close were we to actually being able to feed ourselves? And the answer was quite a ways away. You know, we are not... Not even close to halfway there. But what's your read of that? Do you think that's true, or do you think that we're closer than maybe that estimate told us?
I think that's a pretty keen assessment of it, to be honest. You know, Vermont is really ahead of the curve from a lot of states throughout the country on their localized food system. But also the fact is that we live in a northern state. We have really long winters, and sure, we could probably feed ourselves calorically, right? I saw a news article where someone said that if we wanted to plant potatoes throughout the whole entire state, you know, we could get enough calories for every single Vermonter if we converted more farmland. But who wants to eat potatoes day in and day out? You know, that would not be a fun diet or a good diet to have.
Yeah.
So more realistically, what we're looking at is really a regional food system. So that includes, you know, all our New England states and New York as well. and really identifying what that looks like to be able to feed us regionally. And even when you're looking at that, you know, the goal, one of the goals that have been set by a couple organizations throughout this area is really trying to get to feeding 50% and providing 50% of our food by 2060. So the reality is, I don't think we're going to be able to feed ourselves, especially if folks, you know, want oranges and avocados and coffee and all that other stuff that goes with it. But our farmers are working really hard to be able to provide a lot of the good stuff that we need, you know, like spring greens and, of course, our maple syrup to top our pancakes and some of the beer and wine that's been being produced as well.
Yep. We did talk about the crucial problem of coffee.
Right. How are you going to get people up and going in the morning?
Exactly. I think a lot of Vermonters are heavily reliant on coffee in the morning, myself included. And I'm not picturing that people growing much coffee in Vermont. Roasting it, yes, but not growing it here in the Green Mountains. Until we have some really severe climate change. Yikes. Let's not even go there. But I think it's obviously it's a good thing to think about supporting our local farmers to the extent that, you know, they are providing some of our dietary needs and so on. And obviously, I think a lot of people in Vermont sense that the agricultural economy here is very important in terms of keeping people employed and working and keeping some of our financial wherewithal within the state's borders. So there are many positive aspects of it, but I just also want to keep in perspective that and not get people, you know, sort of overestimating the role of local food. We're going to need to be importing food and related items into Vermont for a long, long time to come, so let's hope that the supply chains of whatever type remain as open as they can, because we rely on them. That's the nature of our current society and the way we feed ourselves and all of that sort of thing. But you have you have some interesting stuff going on, one of the issues with the local food movement in Vermont right now is we had this concern really as of a month ago or so, and I think it still continues to some extent, about farmers markets in the state. Those are a key linchpin of kind of the local food scene here. While they've started up this season, they're looking a lot different than they did last season. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's a fair assessment. And, you know, there was a lot of work happening, you know, within the state and with different organizations that are involved with the farmers markets to make sure that our farmers have an outlet to reach consumers. I think one of the best parts about Vermont is just the mass amount of farmers markets that people can pop into. And, you know, folks rely on that to be able to connect with people throughout their area to not only sell their goods, but on the other side, you know, to pick up those farm fresh goods. So it's been, I think what we're seeing is how adaptable our farms and our farmers markets have been. You know, everybody had to kind of take a step back and reassess what that would look like. And we're seeing a model that I think should be able to carry us through the summer and for as long as this will last. And people are doing a really good job at making sure that everybody is staying safe while still being able to provide that local food.
One of the things that you all are looks like involved in here is the effort by the Vermont Food Bank, State of Vermont, Abbey Group, Vermont National Guard to provide boxes of chicken, produce, dairy products, and non-perishable food at distributions held throughout the state. I gather that event in Berlin last Friday was one of these, and the one today in Middlebury, is that right?
Yeah, and I will say that we're not directly involved with it, but, you know, the Vermont Food Bank and those different groups are involved with the Vermont Farm to Plate Network, but they're really doing an awesome job at making sure that Vermonters who are in need are able to get that food. And I think really one of the biggest things this shows that there's a lot of cracks in our food system, right? And we're seeing that more and more. And it's really driving home the point that there's work that we still need to do to be able to shore that up, because folks shouldn't be having to go hungry, especially when something like this hits and there's so much uncertainty. And it's been inspiring to me to see not only these organizations and agencies step up, but also just communities in general. I don't know where you live, Dave, but in my area, I've just seen an outpouring of support on Front Porch Forum and on different social media of people really wanting to make sure that their neighbors are provided for and they're taken care of. And I really think that's the Vermont way. And that's part of the reason why we're seeing so much success in this, right? We're not just all out for ourselves, but rather we're looking out for each other too, which is pretty inspiring if you ask me.
If you look at the pictures from particularly the Times Argus had from the event in Berlin on Friday, I guess I have to ask, that looks like a lot of need when you see all those cars lined up there around the airport and stretching out onto the interstate and neighboring roads and so on, of people lined up to get food. That tells me that this economic crash we're experiencing is real. It's huge. It's put people way too often into pretty desperate situations. Do you think that those pictures accurately reflect a huge boom in need out there, or do you think that a significant percentage of the folks in that line on Friday were there just because they heard, hey, there's something here for free?
I really do think that it reflects the need. I know UVM came out with a study when this all first hit, and they saw that food insecurity had risen by a third since the pandemic started. And it really kind of paints a picture, for me at least, that a lot of folks in our state, you know, are living one paycheck away from a crisis. And I think that's a shame in and of itself. And while there's a lot of great work happening on the ground, whether that's through our state agencies or whether it's through these organizations or businesses that are stepping up, really, like you said, it's an indictment on what the economy that is making it possible for something to hit like this and people to experience that much need. I wouldn't think that many people are lining up just to pull a freebie, right? And of course, we would encourage people not to do that, because there are people that are truly struggling out there.
Yeah, that's what I was saying at the beginning of this half hour, and we were talking about it with Steve Pappas of the Times Argus in the first half hour this morning. Same kind of conversation.
Right.
Shane, we've been talking a little bit about these food distribution sites around the state. Let's see, the Berlin last Friday, Middlebury today, and by the way, it looks like we're hearing reports of traffic jams around the Middlebury site today. I don't know if they're as bad as they were around Berlin on Friday. I hope not. Shane, tell me a little bit about the any other events along these lines coming up. Is there a list of other sites we're expecting?
Yeah, from what I understand, you folks that are in need and looking for distribution sites and dates can go on the Vermont Food Bank website. And they are constantly updating with more information as these sites are coming online. So if folks are looking to find a spot near them and when that's going to be coming, I would highly suggest checking that out on the internet if you have the ability to do that.
Yeah, let's see. Actually, I think there is a list here. It looks like we are talking about the May 21st, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the Thetford Academy down in the Connecticut River Valley. And once again, Vermont National Guard will be at Thetford Academy tomorrow from, this is May 21st, from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. It's on Academy Road in Thetford, and they're going to be distributing the non-perishable food boxes along with produce, chicken, dairy products provided by the Abbey Group. Anyone is welcome to come and pick up food. May 22nd, that's Friday. So these are happening this week, folks. Lamoille Union High School, that's right in our circulation area. Once again, 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., the Vermont National Guard will be at Lamoille Union High School distributing non-perishable food boxes. So it's pretty much the same drill wherever they go. May 26th, so that would be, let's see, Friday's the 22nd, 3, 4, 5, Tuesday, I conclude. And let's see, Tuesday is going to be at the location to be announced, to be determined. So keep your ears peeled for that. May 27th, which is Wednesday, Brattleboro Union High School will be taking care of some of the food needs in southern Vermont. And in the on May 28th, next week also, the Vermont National Guard will be at the Franklin County Airport in Swanton, and will be distributing food there. So they are getting around the state, all the way, you know, locations all the way from Swanton to Brattleboro, and this obviously is going to be, it's a very important service for a lot of Vermonters who are genuinely in tough straits right now. A lot of folks who have lost their employment, have lost their ability to make an income, and yet have also sometimes struggled to connect with the state in terms of getting some unemployment insurance support, and even some of these payments that are promised, but not all out there yet from the for folks who had been working in the so-called gig economy or for kind of working for themselves and not in the traditional unemployment insurance system. But these things are supposed to be coming. In some cases, they haven't been. And meanwhile, people are struggling out there. And so it's important to know where to go. And this is all, of course, you can go to the Vermont Food Bank website and check out these distribution sites and times and locations, etc. Several coming up just in the next week and a half, and so well worth checking out that website. Shane, you have some other interesting and fun, more fun, frankly, things happening here. One of which is some coaching on cooking local food, including locally caught fish. Tell me about, you have an event coming up on that. What's that going to be about?
Yeah, so tomorrow we are going to be on Facebook Live with the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Department, and we've been doing a couple of these episodes where we're highlighting a wild game piece. So we've done trout and wild turkey, and tomorrow we're going to do some panfish tacos, and we're pairing that as well with some wild edibles that you can find this time of the year. And it's been a lot of fun. What we're showing you is, you know, how to identify those wild edibles, where to look for, and where to go fishing, and just some simple ways to cook it up. The best part to me is that, you know, it's me and another person with our cameras and our phones just kind of put up wherever. Mine's on top of my fridge, and we're both all amateur cooks, and just kind of showing folks how fun and easy it is, you know, with the proper knowledge and making sure that you know to go out and really enjoy a wild meal as well.
So you're going to be cooking some fish tomorrow night?
So Corey Hart from Vermont Fish and Wildlife will be cooking some fish, and then we're going to have another woman on, Cheryl, who's going to be showing us how to cook some stinging nettle as well. And it's always a lot of fun. It lasts about an hour. It's going to start at 5 p.m. And you can find that on the Rooted in Vermont Facebook page. And it's just Rooted in Vermont. And also on the Vermont Fish and Wildlife Facebook page as well.
Excellent. Hey, Shane, I'm about out of time. I got to go. But I really appreciate you taking some time with us this morning. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Shane, I appreciate it.
Shane Rogers with the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund. Stay with us, folks. We'll be back after a break for some CBS News.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
Now,
Now back to the Dave Graham Show on WDEV, FM, and AM.
Thanks for staying with us into our second hour on this Wednesday morning, May the 20th, 2020. And we've got a conversation lined up here with Bill Rakoff, who's a reporter for CBS News. And Bill, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Sure, Dave. Thanks for having me.
And I wanted to check in with you sort of about the latest on coronavirus and particularly what some of the senior federal officials are saying about economic recovery and when that might come around. The Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was quoted yesterday saying the country risks, quote, permanent damage to the economy the longer the lockdown lasts. What does that mean? How likely is that? And how are we going to avoid it?
Yeah, so Dave, you're exactly right. Mnuchin was on Capitol Hill yesterday, along with the Fed chairman, Jerome Powell. They were holding a hearing on the first CARES Act that went out back in March, the $2.2 trillion COVID-19 rescue law. And what basically both of them told senators is that, hey, look, it's working. The responses are making a difference along with the central bank interventions and things of that nature. And so this is news that Republicans wanted to hear, because you recall that Republicans said, hey, you know, let's stop down any further aid till we find out if it's working. Well, they got their first sense yesterday. And by the way, Mnuchin and Powell are in agreement that, you know, the White House and Federal Reserve may need to act more and maybe do it soon. And you're right. What he said was, they both say, is that unemployment is likely to go up again by June before it starts to level out. And as Mnuchin said, the longer people are unemployed, the more damaging it can be for workers and, you know, by proxy, the U.S. economy long term.
Yeah, that's that is kind of a grim picture. I'm wondering, in terms of a follow-on aid package, is there any discussion there of I know that there's been basically a tussle between Democrats and Republicans. Do I have it right that roughly that Democrats are pushing to essentially double down on another giant federal aid package, and that Republicans are offering a bit of resistance and saying, hey, wait a minute?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, the House did pass what they call the HEROES Act, another $3 trillion for state and local governments last week. There was money to prop up the Postal Service. There was money that went into housing programs and things of that nature, money for SNAP, the nutrition benefits program. And that already has passed the House and is sitting, waiting to be taken up by the Senate. But Mitch McConnell has said, you're exactly right, and once again, we want to see how the money that's already been allocated is being spent before we think about taking up another aid bill. And, oh, by the way, if we do take up another bill, it's not going to be a liberal wish list like the HEROES Act. And, in fact, Senator John Kennedy, the Republican from Louisiana, telling people in his mind, he's on the Appropriations Committee, by the way, which we consider such a thing, he thinks there's less than a 50% chance of another bipartisan relief measure. There may be some feints toward it, but this one's going to be a harder slog, it sounds like.
Yeah, that's my impression. And I'm wondering now, what are the stimulus injections into the economy really in the last couple of months has been this federal bump for unemployment benefits. Folks who get unemployment insurance from their states are seeing, I think it's a $600 essentially weekly bonus on top of that from the federal government, which in some cases is pretty generous. And I'm wondering if the, and my understanding is that that's set to expire sometime in July. Is there any talk of extending that?
No, there's not much. I mean, just as much as Republicans are resistant to the idea of further aid, they're also resistant to the idea along with, and that's being directed sort of by the White House, that the resistance to the idea of another aid package. What the president would like to do is put a payroll tax cut in effect rather than providing direct assistance to the taxpayers themselves or the workers. He sees this as sort of a trickle-down effect. If you ease the payroll tax on employers, then they can that eases the ability for them to get paychecks out to their workers however they need to do it. Now, that having been said, a lot of businesses have cut workers' salaries. They've cut back a little bit, so they're reducing them during this time, and so it's not making people whole necessarily. Democrats would like to see, you know, 100% insurance there that would keep people whole through all of this. Republicans, you know, just don't seem to have the appetite for that at the moment.
Yeah, it's interesting. I guess with the payroll tax, one criticism I've heard is that if somebody's unemployed right now, they are not getting a cut in a payroll tax when you're not on a payroll. It's not super helpful to the laid off worker out there. Is that, am I reading that right?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Those who are already laid off, obviously a payroll tax cut won't do anything for them. You know, so what they want to try to do, at least Democrats, is find a way to get some of these people back to work. You know, and again, Republicans say if you do cut the payroll tax, maybe it is easier to bring some of those workers back. I mean, you'll have to see as time goes by. But again, like Mnuchin and Powell were saying on the Hill yesterday, you know, this is kind of like a catch-22, right? You know, we don't want to put out the aid necessarily. However, the longer people are on the unemployment rolls and the longer that number goes up, the worse it is for the U.S. economy. So on the surface, it almost sounds like you've got those two administration officials talking out of both sides of their mouth. At the moment, anyway, you know, things are pretty much where they are. I don't think it's going to move the needle with Republicans anytime soon. I think what may get them to the table is if the numbers in June for unemployment wind up being worse than what they actually project, and that may stir some movement.
Well, and of course, with Powell saying that this is Jerome Powell now, the Federal Reserve chief, saying the economy could take until the end of 2021 to recover fully. I'm wondering your sense of the political impact of that. I mean, obviously, we have an election coming up a year before this estimate of when the economy is expected to recover fully. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, just remember, nothing is done in this town without a political bent on it. So politics is always part of the equation in these discussions. And this is the tricky maneuvering that everybody's trying to do. And it's one of the reasons that Republicans are kind of holding up on this aid. They're hearing from their conservative constituents and are buying some of the talking points that have been going on here. Why should we as a government, why should we as a taxpayer prop up failing local and state governments who failed to prepare for this pandemic? That's one that conservatives have taken a real bite on. And, you know, just remember, we've already allocated upwards of $9 trillion with Republicans signing on there. Now comes a measure, you know, maybe too little too late or just symbolic of some fiscal responsibility that would play well with the votes back home. So, yeah, we'll see how it goes. But, you know, even if you're talking about holding up this aid until the election, should Republicans lose the majority in the Senate, then they'd have an all-Democratic Congress to deal with whoever is in the White House. It might be able to push that aid through a little bit easier. Otherwise, it sounds like they'll still be at loggerheads.
Yeah. Well, all right. Bill Rakoff of CBS News, I appreciate you joining me this morning. It's always good talking with you, and let's do this again soon.
Thank you, Dave.
Here we are pretty much smack dab in the middle of spring. It feels like spring's been slow to get here. Lots of chilly weather so far since the vernal equinox, but we are finally starting to get some sunshine and temperatures warming up a little bit, and spring also is a time when the Vermont fishing season gets underway and folks start taking to our stream banks. I am hearing, and we're going to find out a little bit about this, that maybe fishing is even more popular this spring than it has been in other recent years, perhaps because of the opportunity for folks to get outside and pursue a fun and relaxing outdoor activity while maintaining their social distancing and keeping with all the rules surrounding the COVID-19 crisis. And going to be talking about all of this morning with a fishing enthusiast. Chris Bouchard is on the phone with us. Good morning, Chris.
Hey, Dave. How's it going?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Oh, not too bad. Enjoying the sunshine.
Uh-huh. And Sean Good is with the State Department of Fish and Wildlife, fisheries biologist, and someone who can give us some of the nuts and bolts on what fish are biting and what times of year are best, et cetera, I'm sure. And Sean Good is on the line as well. Thank you very much for joining me, Sean. I think Sean Good is on the line with us. Okay. Well, we're going to try to get Sean Good back. We had him for a moment, but I think he took just a nibble at the line and then went away. This is about fishing, after all. So, you know, you're going to have some of those. Chris Bouchard, I'm hoping that you're still on the hook, are you?
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, good. And let's get into this. You are tell me a little bit about your own fishing enthusiasm or career, or however you want to describe it. Do you do any guiding, or is this just something you do for yourself, or are you telling me about all that?
Sure. Yeah. You know, ever since I was a kid, you know, growing up in Maine, my parents would bring me out fishing, but you know, we just did a little bit of perch fishing here and there. And once I attended Linden State College, I sort of fell out of fishing for a time, but rediscovered it, you know, when I was able to spend more time around the Northeast Kingdom. And there's so many great bodies of water to fish that, you know, I just had to explore them and rediscovered the sport. And, you know, about the past 15 years or so, I've been, you know, very adamant about doing it, not just in the Kingdom, but, you know, exploring other parts of the state as well. And now I live in Northwest Vermont, and, you know, I get out on Lake Champlain quite a bit, and, you know, the fishing opportunities there are really unparalleled. So it's just a fun way for me to get outside, enjoy the outdoors, you know, get a little solitude now and then, some quiet time, and, you know, bring home a meal or two.
Yeah, that's it's interesting that we actually are. I thought it was a good segue on the program today, because we were talking in the last half hour with Shane Rogers of the Vermont Sustainable Jobs Fund's Rooted in Vermont program, and they're actually going to be doing a program tomorrow night on Facebook about cooking up a meal made up of Vermont panfish and some I think some stinging nettles as your greens. And it's going to be, yeah. I'm sure it'll get a lot of hits on Facebook, and that there will be ample opportunities for folks to try their own culinary skills out in the kitchen with some totally native Vermont eating. That'll be fun for folks, I think.
Yeah, and, fantastic. Yeah,
I believe that Sean Good is back on the hook here.
Yeah, somehow I got dropped. I'm here, Dave. Thanks a lot. I'm on a landline, so I'm not exactly sure how that happened, but oh well, I'm back.
Yeah, you know, we used to have this theory that the landlines were more reliable than cell phones, but that may be changing, at least in Vermont. I don't know what the theory is these days nationwide, but I've heard a lot of people complaining about spotty landline service, and maybe cell coverage is getting a little better, so they could they could cross each other in reliability at some point. But anyway, now that we have you, that's great. Now, Sean, you are a fisheries biologist with the Department of Fish and Wildlife, correct?
Yes, that's right. So I've been with the department for 23 years now. I am based out of the Rutland office, so I'm responsible for managing fisheries in the southwestern corner of the state, including Southern Champlain and all the watersheds that flow westward off the Green Mountains. But I also have statewide responsibilities for fisheries management. Part of my role that's sort of growing lately is getting more active in fishing education and outreach, trying to get people excited and energized about getting out and enjoying what we, you know, are providing in terms of quality recreational fishing opportunities around the state through our conservation and management activities. We want people out there fishing and participating in this great sport, and we just want to let them know, you know, what sort of opportunities we have. We have an incredible diversity of fish species around the state in all of our water bodies that can be targeted and angled for, and you know, I think you mentioned in the intro, we're seeing a recent sort of resurgence in angling participation as indicated through license sales. There's a lot of people out fishing right now, and that's partly because of this COVID-19 situation, obviously.
Yeah. Do you think that is, I mean, I can imagine sort of under that heading of COVID-19 prompting more fishing, a couple of kind of sub headings or whatever. One would say people want food. There's a lot of worry about where's my next meal coming from, especially for folks who are have more time than money right now. And going to the grocery store is tough if you have been laid off and are still haven't received that first payment from the state unemployment insurance system because of their problems. You might be in a situation where some of that protein would be really, really nice right now. The other aspect of it is, I would think, is just people have more time. If you're laid off from work, kids are home from school, maybe there's, right. What are we going to do today? Hey, how about we go fishing?
Yeah, both of those points are exactly right on. So, you know, to the first point, the sort of national trend, the research has been done on the social side of fishing participation, you know, clearly points to the fact that it's the lack of time and availability that kind of gets people away from fishing. You know, life happens. They have kids. They go to school, you know, kids' sports and activities and jobs. It's just, people want to participate, but they don't necessarily have the time. And right now, that whole obstacle to fishing participation has sort of disappeared for a lot of people. They have time on their hands now. And then the second point, you know, people are looking for, you know, some sort of return on that time they spend. Like Chris mentioned, some of that, you know, other motivation to get out fishing is just to reconnect with nature and spend some time alone in solitude. But, you know, one of the other benefits is that we have this local source of sustainable, protein in terms of fish that we manage through the department activities to, you know, keep those populations healthy and wholesome and available. And those opportunities are out there. You also mentioned the Rooted in Vermont and the department Facebook Live event that's happening tomorrow, where our Let's Go Fishing coordinator, Corey Hart, will be with Shane Rogers cooking up some panfish. You know, panfish are one of those species that sort of adult anglers forget about to a large degree. It's the fish species that people think are kind of, you know, put off to the side, you know, and is the realm of kids fishing off a dock with a worm and a bobber, and that's really all panfish are there for. But you know, panfish is hugely popular in other parts of the country. The Midwest is in particular. And we have, you know, bluegill, pumpkin seed sunfish, rock bass, black crappie, white crappie, yellow perch, white perch. All of these small panfish populations are in just about every lake and pond around the state. And with some really simple equipment and gear, you can catch them from the shore, from boats, and they're fantastic to eat. We always serve panfish at some of our fishing festivals. Our summer fishing festival at Grand Isle and our winter ice fishing festival. And people are frankly shocked and surprised when we're serving these panfish, battered and fried, just how delicious they are. And the fact that they're available all over the state, you know, is something that people really should pay attention to.
Sean, you're making me hungry, I got to say. Start getting into that late morning, a little stomach rumble thing going, and I'm thinking, some nice fried panfish would be pretty tasty right now. But I also wanted to ask Chris Bouchard. Chris, you mentioned that you grew up in Maine, and I'm wondering, when you were fishing as a young person in Maine, obviously there's that whole 1,000-mile coastline over there. Were you fishing saltwater or mainly freshwater?
Well, we did a little bit of both as I was growing up. You know, I can remember some of my earliest fishing memories were, you know, with my father in his boat out catching those exact panfish that Sean was just mentioning. But, you know, there was a big fishery there for striped bass and bluefish as well, and we'd go target those in the ocean from time to time. Really ran the gamut. As I got a little older and was able to go fishing by myself, you know, brook trout became the big thing. You know, I'd spend an afternoon during the summer just wandering brooks and fishing every little pool and bringing home a few fish and frying them up, and a lot of great memories.
Yeah. What is your favorite fish, Chris, for eating?
Well, I'd have to say probably the tastiest one that I've ever landed. I've only caught once, and that was the elusive Lake Whitefish, which is in Lake Champlain. It was kind of a fluke that I landed one of those, but I did land a nice one a few years ago, and I'll tell you, if you can get your hands on one of those, bring it home, because they are very good. Almost tasted like sea scallops. Excellent eating.
Ah, wow. Wow.
Yeah, that's a great... Oops. Sorry, Dave. Go ahead.
No. You were going to say, Sean, go, your turn.
Yeah, I was just going to say, you know, Chris brings up a great point. You know, we have 92 different fish species in Vermont, which may be, you know, a surprising fact to a lot of listeners. And many of them are fish that a lot of people have never heard of that are actually very palatable. And Lake Whitefish is one of those very unknown fish species that are actually quite abundant in Lake Champlain. Sort of hard to figure out, but when you catch one, I mean, there's a commercial fishing market for these things in the Great Lakes. They're so valued as a food fish, and smoked whitefish is one of the probably greatest freshwater fish delicacies there are, and we have them here in Vermont. It's just a matter of, you know, getting out there and trying to catch one. And yeah, I agree, Chris.
Wow, that is something. I actually have friends who really relish smoked whitefish. I mean, it's something that I think fetches a good price in some delis and so on. So that's interesting. By the way, for a total fishing rookie, if you're out there on the lake and you pull something up and you go, what is this? Is there a good reference, a good book you should bring along in your boat or whatever?
So the department put out, I want to say 10 or years ago or so, a book called Fishes of Vermont. It's available for about $20 on the department website. We have a store that sells a small number of items, and that book is available there. I've seen it for sale on Amazon, too, at much higher cost. I don't know why it's marked up so high there, but it was written by department staff, three biologists here within the agency, two with Fish and Wildlife, one with DEC, and it documents and details, you know, fish habitat, fish life history, fish species identification for all Vermont fish species. It's a really good resource that I think people should have. You know, mentioning that, there is one kind of caution I would put out to listeners. If you catch something that you don't know what it is and you don't have the resources handy to identify it quickly, you probably should let it go. Because, you know, we do have regulations, you know, that pertain to some species and not others, and some species can be confused with others. And there's a good example of that happening this winter, where somebody was out ice fishing and they thought they had a limit of northern pike. Turns out one of those fish was a muskellunge, which is illegal to harvest. And
yikes.
So that was...
Hey, you know what? I got to go to a break here, but let's talk more about that when we get back. We're going to be talking more with Sean Good and Chris Bouchard about fishing in Vermont when we return. Some CBS News upcoming. A couple words from our sponsors. We'll be back shortly, folks.
A message from the Warren Store. Life bounces us around to places we never would have imagined. The best we can hope for is that we approach it with grace, strength, purpose, and humor. Experiences like these will be remembered all our lives. How we responded and changed with challenge, countless stories of kindness, innovation, bravery, and good humor have captured our imagination and raised our spirits. The human spirit is far more powerful than what we're dealing with now. We will get through this together.
It's the Dave Graham Show on WDEV.
We're back with Sean Good of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife, and Chris Bouchard. He's an angler and somebody who is a well-experienced fisher person from originally from Maine, but now has been plying the stream banks in Vermont for quite a number of years, and really appreciate you gentlemen staying with us into the last half hour of today's program. Before we resume our conversation, I did want to interject a couple of announcements. One is concerns our podcast. You just heard an ad for the Warren Store, and they are a sponsor of our podcast, which reminded me I need to tell folks that if you miss any of our conversations that happen live live between 9 and 11 a.m. on weekday mornings here on WDEV. You can always go to WDEV.com, follow the link from there to the Dave Graham Show. Scroll down a bit, you'll be able to come up with a list of our recent programs by guest and by topic, and listen to your heart's content any time of day or night. And we, again, thank the Warren Store for their sponsorship for our podcast. The other thing I wanted to mention was just after 11 o'clock this morning, we'll obviously go to some hourly CBS news as we do here on WDEV, FM, and AM. But just after that, we will be going to live special coverage of Governor Phil Scott and other top state officials holding one of their regular Monday, Wednesday, Friday news conferences that they've been conducting as a part of the effort to keep the public informed about the state's response to the COVID-19 crisis. And obviously that continues. There's always a lot of news coming out of these news conferences these days. A lot of it has to do with the governor's talk of turning the spigot and trying to get the economy opened up again to the extent possible without creating a lot of new risk of disease outbreak. And so we'll be hearing more about all of that just after 11 o'clock. Don't touch that dial. So we have a caller on the line also. I believe I didn't catch the name, but somebody from Websterville. Good morning.
Hey, good morning. You're a fish biologist. I got a question about the salmon hole in Winooski.
Sure.
And can you go in there? What time do you – you can't go in there until about the – June 15th, right?
That's correct. The hole itself is a closed spawning water, and it opens up later in the year. So it's currently closed. You're correct.
Okay, it is currently closed. Okay, that I always thought.
Yes.
Yeah. A species of fish that I'm concerned about, sir, is sheephead. My wife was from the Philippines, and she prepared sheephead a certain way that it was just so delicious, but people threw them away. But I was just concerned, wondering about sheephead.
Yeah, sheep's head is sort of a nickname for a native fish species we have exclusively in Lake Champlain. Its true name is called freshwater drum. And they are related to the drum family that you'll find down in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Louisiana and Texas, black drum, red drum, things like that. It's the only freshwater species of that fish family, and we have them in Lake Champlain. And sometimes they're called croakers. You'll hear that nickname as well. But
okay, I've heard of croakers.
Yeah, and they are pretty tasty from what I understand when prepared the proper way. And like all fish species, there's certain ways that make bring out the flavor better than the same method will with another fish species. And one of the best ways I've heard for doing in a chowder, they can be a little bit of an oily fish, but prepared properly, they're quite tasty. And that's another one of the examples of the diversity of native fish species we have in Vermont that are abundant and can be caught on a rod and reel that many people are unaware of.
Right, right. Well, that's why I wanted to bring it up, because we used to go there a couple of years ago, and we would catch tons of whitefish, or what people call suckers, and then she would make chowders with those two kinds of fish, the sheephead, or the ones you called, in the whitefish.
Yep.
And I just wanted to bring that out, that people would say, hey, do you want these? But they're delicious eating in chowders.
Yeah, I know, a small number of people in Vermont that have caught them and prepared them and have said very similar things. And people should give kind of increase their palate a little bit and try some new things.
Right. Well, thank you very much. I just wanted to bring that up.
All righty. Thanks for the call. And by the way, folks, we welcome more calls and comments from listeners out there. The local number in Waterbury, 244-1777. The toll-free number is 877-291-8255 if you want to give WDEV Dave Graham Show a call, and you can have a chat with both Sean Good of the Vermont Department of Fish and Wildlife and also Chris Bouchard, an angler here in Vermont who has been developed a number of years of expertise on how to catch good fish in Vermont. Chris, tell me about your experience. You said you live in northwestern Vermont and have fished some on Lake Champlain. Have you caught much in the way of the sheep's head we just heard about and or the whitefish?
Well, just the whitefish I mentioned earlier. Sheep's head so far has eluded me. I understand, though, from listening to Sean, that this is the time of year when they're spawning, and they do congregate in certain spots. But I've yet to be able to locate them. But, you know, they can be quite large. I understand they're a hard fighting fish. And now that Sean's saying that they're pretty good eating, it's just going to motivate me a bit more. But so far, that one's eluded me.
It sounds like those are three winning factors, right? If they're big, they fight, and they're good eating, right? That's what you want, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, it hits all the points, yes, right?
Hits all the high points, right? Yeah, that's interesting. And Sean, talk to us a little bit about, you know, what are your favorite for catching and eating in Vermont? What do you really like out there? It's a good day when you catch what?
Yeah, if I'm looking to go out and catch a meal of fish, my go-to is panfish. I mean, I like eating yellow perch and crappie. You know, I'll throw some bluegill in there as well. And, you know, I like them lightly breaded with some panko crumbs and flour, you know, dipped in an egg wash and then fried. And sort of lately I've been getting into making fish tacos out of those, so kind of preparing the fillets into finger-sized pieces and then, you know, individually breading and frying those and then putting them in a soft tortilla wrap with some, you know, sliced avocado, red onion, a little bit of salsa and sour cream and a squeeze of lime. It honestly, it'll make you think you're sitting in some cabana on the beach in the Caribbean somewhere.
I'll be over for lunch today. How's that sound?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, but sport fish wise, I fish for a lot of, you know, different species. You know, I started out probably being most intrigued and involved with bass fishing. I love fishing for big northern pike, muskie, but I've gotten into some of the weird fish lately too, you know, some of these interesting species that we have in Vermont that most people don't target, like long-nosed gar and bowfin and freshwater drum or sheep's head. You know, these, I think it's a challenge, and it kind of is part of that motivation to push yourself to try to learn something about a new species you don't know anything about and try to catch one. And we have so many cool fish here. As a matter of fact, I'm going out specifically tomorrow to try to catch carp, which, you know, can exceed 40 pounds in Vermont in Lake Champlain in the Connecticut River. An average carp is 15 to 20 pounds, but we have them double that size, and you know, it'll test your, you know, strength of your gear and your will as an angler like no other fish we have. They're just very strong. Now, they are an introduced species that have been here for about 150 years, but you know, their angling opportunities are all over you know, the lake and the Connecticut River as well.
Now, tell me a little bit about your bait and tackle and so on. What do you use to catch carp?
Carp are a bottom feeder. They root up, you know, mussels and snails, crayfish. They'll also plant material. They eat, you know, the shoots and tubers of aquatic plants that are rooted in the bottom. So you want to have something that's kind of, you know, I guess live bait, so to speak. You can catch them with a worm quite easily on the bottom, but you know, you can catch them with your prepared baits as well. A lot of people use corn, simply, you know, kernel corn on a hook, or you can buy commercial carp bait called boilies, which is a mixture of, you know, flour and cornmeal with some scent in it. But they're very sensitive, and they have very refined, you know, senses of taste and smell and scent. It also makes them difficult to catch because when they pick something up that doesn't feel right, they spit it out really quickly. And a metal hook in their mouth, you know, often a carp will mouth your bait and spit it out without you ever knowing that happened. And there's sort of, you know, ways that the Europeans who fish for carp a lot have designed, you know, to make a carp rig where your bait is not actually on the hook. It's on the line below the hook, and the hook is unbaited up above, and they kind of suck in your bait without feeling or sensing the hook. But, you know, then they start to move away, and then the hook sort of rotates into their mouth before they realize it. And so that's sort of the technique that we'll be using tomorrow.
Wow, and you're going on the Connecticut or on Lake Champlain tomorrow?
We're going to fish over on Lake Champlain, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And is this a particularly strong type? I'm sorry?
It's shore-based, you know, that you find a place along the shoreline where, you know, you're near sort of a soft-bottom, marshy cattail area, and, you know, that's sort of the area that the carp are roaming most of the time. And so, you know, you can do it with very simple, straightforward gear from shore. It's a rush catching a fish that big. And again, you know, prepared right, a lot of people say they taste quite good.
Wow. Well, that sounds like fun. It sounds like we're going to get some listeners out there who might be thinking about heading out and catching. If you are in a situation where you are feeling the pinch on paying grocery bills because maybe you're laid off from work right now, a 15, 20-pound fish probably hold your family for a couple days anyway, you know, and that's in terms of protein. Wow, that would be quite a nice catch for you. So something for people to think about. Chris Bouchard, I'm wondering, same question about carp. Have you caught many of those on Lake Champlain?
I can't say that I've caught any on the lake, but probably 4 or 5 years ago, I remember along the Burlington waterfront, there was a whole giant school of them that had taken up residence near where the old canal comes in off Pine Street. And everybody along the bike path could see these giant fish just swimming around for days and days in pretty shallow water. And we tried throwing everything at them, including corn and, you know, some of the things Sean mentioned there, but they weren't having it. So none on the lake proper, but they also will be moving up into some of the bigger rivers below the dams here that feed into Lake Champlain this time of year. The Winooski River below the closed section down in Colchester and Winooski can be good areas to catch carp right about now. They'll be up in there, and that's where I caught one a few years ago at night on just a crawler just thrown out there. You know, it wasn't a huge fish, but by carp standards, but it was still probably 15 pounds. So you want to talk about a fight, then it's hard to beat a carp for fight.
Yeah, that is something. Hey, we have a caller on the line. Diana from Milton's checking in. Good morning, Diana.
Good morning. I have a question for Chris. I heard you mention crappie. Where is a good place to go crappie fishing in Vermont?
Well, that's another species that I haven't quite mastered. I have caught some down in Ferrisburg in some of the swampy areas there, but maybe, Sean, you could give some ideas.
Yeah, so right now at this time of year is probably one of the best times for trying to catch some crappie. They're a spring spawning species, so you know the crappie are sort of funneling into backwater, marshy, shallow areas. So what you want to do is look for, you know, shallow bays, particularly culverts or bridges, you know, where a road goes over between the main lake and marsh, and you know the fish will travel through these areas and sort of bottleneck down through to get into those backwater spots, and they're going in there to spawn. So you know, if you were to fish from shore or a boat along the edges of the cattails and the reeds that are just starting to come up, with small jigs, you know, on a piece of worm or a small minnow or something like that, it's really, you know, difficult to pinpoint an exact spot or location because, you know, black crappie are present in most waters around the state and extensively on Lake Champlain. You also get white crappie on Lake Champlain, and both those species are, you know, moving into the shallow backwater areas right now to spawn. A great tool for anglers around the state to use that the department provides that will help you figure some of that out is the Vermont Master Angler Program website. If you go onto our website and look under fishing programs, you'll find the Vermont Master Angler Program website that has a gallery of entries. This is an angler recognition program that people can enter fish when they catch one that it exceeds a trophy-sized benchmark that we've set for 33 different fish species. So if you go to the entry gallery, and you can sort that gallery by species, so just choose crappie off the list, and it'll show you all the crappie that have been entered into 10 years of that program. And it'll also show you what time of year they were caught, what lake they were caught. So this is a tool that anglers can use to sort of help narrow down different opportunities. So you can select May and the species off the list, and it'll show you where people have been catching crappie during the month of May over the last 10 years. You can even
Diana, let me ask you about
specific years.
Diana, yeah. Let me ask you about your question about crappie. Is that a favorite fish of yours for eating?
Absolutely. I'm from Missouri, and we have lots and lots of white crappie down there. And it's one of the best tasting fish that you can buy or can catch and eat.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good endorsement. Yeah, that's actually I have a family over in New Hampshire who in-laws who go fishing for crappie over there all the time, and I have had some crappie chowder and other dishes involving crappie, and I will agree that it is it's good eating fish and definitely something that people who know it do love it, and so and it is good to know that it is abundant in Vermont's waters. And so go out there and catch yourself some crappie, folks. It's it is definitely worthwhile. So, Diana, thank you for the call. Appreciate it. Sean, I'm wondering, I wanted to get back to the discussion, though, that I had to interrupt because we were going to our bottom of the hour break, and I didn't want to let it go completely. You were talking about the responsibility of the angler to know what they're catching, and it actually, if you don't know what you're catching and you catch the wrong thing, you can be in some hot water.
Yes, yeah, that's correct. I was just using an example that happened this past winter where we have a restoration species program going on for muskellunge. It's a native species that the numbers dwindled drastically in the late 1970s, and we've been restocking this species in the Missisquoi River and Missisquoi Bay area. But they're related to the northern pike. They look very similar in size and shape. And you really have to pay attention to the patterns and the coloration of the two species to tell them apart. The northern pike, anglers are able to, you know, harvest five a day over 20 inches in length. Muskellunge, you're not allowed to harvest them at all right now during the period of time that we're trying to restore their numbers to our waters. And so it's really important for anglers, of course, to know how to tell, you know, fish species apart. And that's just one example of many others where, you know, you can, one regulation applies to one species that is very similar in appearance to another one that has a different regulation altogether. So it really is important for people to, you know what's what. And the Fishes of Vermont book is a great way to do that. The Master Angler Program website, looking at the gallery, it's full of, you know, thousands of photos of, you know, angler-caught fish of all species around the state. So, you know, there's definitely tools out there people can use.
Yeah, and that is important. I'm sorry, you were saying?
I was just going to interject, too, that, yeah, you know, those are good points, John. And I was also going to just, you know, mention that the time of the year can also affect the appearance of fish, some fish species. landlocked salmon come to mind. You know, when they're doing their spawn in October and November, they'll turn rather brown. And, you know, if you're not looking closely at them when you catch one, you might assume it's a brown trout. And, you know, depending on where you take one, you might end up in some hot water. But, you know, it's also the time of year that comes into play.
And so, Sean, you can actually, I mean, so the along comes a Fish and Wildlife warden who's going to be looking at your catch, and what kinds of fines are possible if you have the wrong thing in your boat?
You know, I honestly don't know. I don't want to try to, you know, give an answer to that might end up being wrong. The enforcement side of things is something I don't get closely involved with.
Okay.
You know, and that's often, you know, at the discretion of the warden, mm-hmm. under the certain, you know, situation, whether it's a civil or criminal fine or ticket. You know, I do know that oftentimes it results in points, you know, against you, and the accumulation of a certain number of points could end up resulting in your loss of license for a period of time. And to many anglers, you know, that's worse than the monetary, you know, penalty, being able to fish for 3 or 5 years. And so really the bottom line is just, you know, it's anglers' responsibility to be aware of and familiar with, you know, all the regulations that we have in place. And they are in place for, you know, purposes that have to do with fisheries management and conservation. Those rules are there so that we can continue managing and providing fishing opportunities around the state for everybody to enjoy. And, you know, it's important for everybody to follow those.
Yeah. And obviously, this is the long-term goal of this agency, the Department of Fish and Wildlife in the state of Vermont, is to keep our fish and wildlife populations healthy so that they can be enjoyed by this generation and many, many more to come, of people who really are thrilled to get out there in nature and see what they can find in terms of fish and wildlife available on our in Vermont's environment. Crucial stuff. One last question for you, Sean, which is a lot of worry about tourism this summer in Vermont. Has that shown up in the fishing license sales statistics yet? Are people not buying licenses because they don't think they'll be able to come here?
Yeah. The governor's, stay home, stay safe orders early on, and still with the recent amendments, you know, have required non-residents, out-of-staters, to either not come at all or quarantine for 14 days after arrival before
that's tough,
going
yeah.
out.
Hey,
that's pretty impossible to come, you know, as an angler to and abide by that right now.
Sean Good and Chris Bouchard, thank you so much for joining me this morning. It's great talking with you guys. Good luck out there on the lakes and streams of Vermont. And we will head into the end of the Dave Graham Show here for this Wednesday morning. Thanks for joining us, folks. And join us again tomorrow. Stay tuned now for the governor's news conference on the COVID-19. Have a good day, everybody.